from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll get a preview of the holiday classic White Christmas at Footlight Musicals.
I'll talk with author Barb Shoup about what's going on at the Indiana Writers Center.
And I'll get a look at the IMA's new design galleries opening next week. Plus, there'll be our calendar of events we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Some guys, some gals, some tunes, and a charming Vermont hotel. Stir together, add some picturesque snow, and you have Irving Berlin's White Christmas. It's Footlight Musical's next production, and Sharon Gamble invited its director, Bob Harbin, to our studios to learn the story.
White Christmas, the film, is a classic, and one or another station plays it over and over and over again at the holidays.
Do you remember... You're probably too young to remember.
Oh, that's a nice way to start, Bob. Thank you.
do you remember in days of yore when these movies were made, and then at once a year they were wonderful family excursions.
Yeah,
like,
sure.
You know, The Wizard of Oz, which is shown now 3 or 4 times a year by
at Easter, which
all the makes sense. but it like one night on CBS at 7 o'clock, you would sit in front of the television set with the whole family and you'd watch it. Once a year. And the same thing, you know, you couldn't wait to find out when are they going to play White Christmas this year.
Sure.
And families would plan around that date so they could sit together and watch this film. And now,
for those of you under 30 who are going, what? We'll explain it to you.
And now they take all of those Christmas treasures and just sort of put them on a roll.
Yeah, exactly. It's a Wonderful Life.
Those cartoony ones.
And even the newer ones like Olive, the Other Reindeer.
Yes, charming, the Drew Barrymore piece. Yes.
Yeah, lovely. Yeah. So... But the tell us the story of the, I mean, normally works of art go from stage to screen, and this one did the opposite, and the musical's way newer than the film. What's the story there?
The film, of course, was, I think, 1954, and I think it was Rodgers and Hammerstein on the rights, because of the Irving Berlin Library. Mm-hmm. And I think they decided that, you know, enough already. It was so popular. Why not attempt to make, a stage musical out of it, which is very popular. I mean, they're doing it with all kinds of films now, because no one has a creative thought left in their mind.
Also another conversation.
There you are.
Yeah,
yes,
it's like,
that's another
interview. We're bereft of creative new ideas for the stage. Let's just adapt a film.
Yeah, let's do 9 to 5. anyway, so they did that. They came up with a book, and they added more music to actually make it a musical. The film is not... I don't think it's probably not categorized as a musical necessarily.
No,
there are musical
it's a film
numbers.
With music, which is not really a genre
exactly.
anymore.
Exactly. Yeah. So this is truly a musical with added Irving Berlin songs, like I Love a Piano has been added, Blue Skies, wonderful other Irving Berlin, and not necessarily seasonal, but they're very much like that. They're big dance numbers.
Sure. Chance to show off.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
So the original film had music and lyrics by Irving Berlin, and David Ives and Paul Blake created the book for the contemporary musical, which is what you're using at Footlight. So there's a couple of guys. They're veterans. The story
Bob and Phil. Bob Wallace and Phil Davis were in the service together, and after we assume that after the war was over, they got together and became very famous musical comedy stars.
Mm-hmm.
And they, Wallace and Davis was then became a very big stage entity. And they are playing a nightclub, and they go to see a friend's sisters, and Phil immediately is smitten with one of the sisters. They follow them to Vermont for a snowy evening, and of course there's no snow in Vermont. It's 70 degrees, and they don't know what to do. And they end up putting on a play in a barn. The lodge that they end up is owned by their general from the war, and they are reunited with him. And in order to help him keep his property, they decide to put on a show there. There's some confusion so that, you know, boy gets girl, boys get girls, boy loses girl.
There has to be some
complication. Yeah, they get back together.
Have to be some obstacles.
It's a little loose. you could tear some of that apart if you wanted to. But it's all good 1940s, 50s fun. You know, this is another sort of age thing. I sat down with the cast, with the four leads the other night, and I said, you know, we need to talk about the difference in courting. You know, and they're like, what? Dating? Going out?
What do lawyers have to do with it, right?
that it's different, and when we went to see films in older times, you knew the outcome, but it didn't matter.
Right.
You expected it was the
road. It was the journey.
Exactly. And it's how you got there and how terrific and fun it was to do that.
And going to a movie theater was some privacy.
Absolutely.
You could hold hands.
Absolutely.
You could put your arm around a pretty girl for the first time or vice versa.
You know, we didn't proceed as quickly on dates in those days as perhaps some might do today.
Uh-huh.
But I mentioned the other night when they were doing that, the show opens with them doing a show in front of their compatriots on location at war. And I said, this is something, you know, that Bob Hope used to do all the time.
Oh, no.
And yes, it's true.
How old are your cast members? 30s?
Well, one's 27 and one's maybe early 30s.
Okay.
And I said, yes, because I was making a joke about Dorothy L'Amour. And they're, who? And I said, oh, my. there's a whole volume. There are volumes of road shows, you know, with Bob Hope and oh, my goodness, and Bob Hope, and Bing Crosby.
Yep.
They had not heard of any of them, so their assignment this weekend is to find a road picture.
They're going
to
be spending some quality time with a DVD or YouTube or
yes,
Netflix streaming. Yeah, because there are all those cultural references that would have been for these characters in the 40s that would have been very relevant.
Absolutely, and they forgot that my goodness, Bob Hope used to travel with, Marilyn Monroe,
right.
and Betty Grable and all of the, you know, huge stars at the time who volunteered and took time to go out and entertain the troops. So it's that, and that's the way that the musical starts. So it'll be some good homework for them.
Yeah, absolutely. So I love that. Yes, it's theoretically about Christmas, but mm-hmm. all these other songs like How Deep Is the Ocean, Count Your Blessings, Sisters, it's just an excuse for this great music.
I think it's
well, that that's
a lot
a little
of great
harsh.
Music that just
it's
happens
partly an excuse for this
just
great music.
Takes place in December.
Yeah.
And that's a wonderful thing. Even White Christmas, you know, is from Holiday Inn. It's not from
right.
Because I know when I think many times when you sing Happy Holiday, we always, it's Happy Holidays.
Right.
And it's Happy Holiday from Holiday Inn as
uh-huh.
well. So it's kind of a lot of wonderful music thrown together, and there's a tree at the end.
Aww.
And you know, it just might snow on stage.
No.
It just might snow. So they didn't get it in Vermont, but
we're not going to ask because, you know, of course, then you have to clean up the snow.
Yes, you. It's like there's an elephant on stage.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So What kind of accompaniment does this have? Does this have a little pit band?
No, we're going to have like 14 piece.
Oh, a big and, ensemble.
And you know, Footlight Musicals has this wonderful pit situation with the instrumentation underneath the stage in the front, but yet they've done this wonderful job of covering it so that you can still use that stage space, and the audience is not separated from the action on stage as much.
Yeah, let me ask you a question though. This is a 4-member cast, right?
Oh no, we have 27.
Okay, so there is a big ensemble behind.
Yes,
okay.
Yes. There's
and who are they in the story?
Because when they decide to do the play for the general, they have decided we will do our Wallace and Davis act that we would normally do, but we'll do it in Vermont. It's like rather than a tryout in Florida, which I think a lot of acts used to do, they'll do a tryout in Vermont. So that means all of their singers and dancers. So we have 8 amazing women and 4 amazing guys who are all dancing. We have some tappers. We have some wonderful ballroom. Oh, the best things happen while you're dancing. Is in this as well. So there's some wonderful ballroom activity. There's the woman who works at the lodge who overhears the conversation, which leads to our drama. there's the general, his granddaughter. My goodness, there's a whole barn full of people running around with nothing to do. And they're just going to show up just for you so you can see some wonderful dancing and hear some wonderful singing.
That's great. So how many different locations are in this show? This sounds like a fairly...
New York.
Fairly complicated
Vermont,
set.
Actually.
No?
Well, there's the barn, there's the inn, there's the Ed Sullivan Show. Another piece of history that no one knew anything about.
Thank goodness they have you for a director.
I tried to convince them. I said, you know, even the Beatles didn't get on Ed Sullivan the first time they tried. That how prestigious it was.
Sure.
To appear on Ed Sullivan, and so the fact that Wallace and Davis was on the show,
right,
would establish
the
people exactly that you're not just, you know, from Hoboken. You are an legit act.
Yeah, yeah. So, but for audiences, potential audience members who are hearing this, you don't have to know those cultural references. This is just a fun show.
You know,
if you do, it's fine, but if you don't, it's okay.
I love Irving Berlin, but I think that a lot of times you hear those wonderful old songs, and I don't always know which one did it. But they're toe tappers, they're finger snappers, they're just enjoyable, wonderful pieces of music.
They're, take this in the right way, anti-Sondheim. You go out and you know the tune.
Yes. You as soon as it starts playing, you go, I didn't know that was in, you know, that sort of thing.
Sure.
And you do, you remember those old, and I, you know, of course, I always shed a tear, but those, how far will I travel? Amazing, wonderful songs that if you're over 40, you're going to recognize, you're going to get, and if you're under 40, you'll be introduced and become fans.
Some of those love songs are not nearly as well known as they should be because they're still universal and people don't hear them anymore.
Well, I'm not sure that we don't have a showcase for them much anymore. I mean, we used to have, I think, a lot more variety shows. And in their day, each one of those variety shows had their Christmas special.
Mm-hmm.
Dinah Shore, Perry Como, Dean Martin. They would always, Jackie Gleason. They would always have their huge holiday time, and that's, I think, when many of those songs were then sang or performed by the June Taylor dancers and people like that. Or you know, what happened to Lawrence Welk, you know, who made a fortune with those, playing those old...
Lives on occasionally on our sister station, TV20.
Yes, that's wonderful.
Sharon Gamble with Bob Harbin, director of Footlight Musicals' White Christmas. The production opens November 22nd and runs through December 15th, with evening performances at 7:30 and Sunday matinees at 2:30. Learn more and get tickets at footlight.org. It's Footlight, FOOTLITE.org, footlight.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. Whether you're a nervous beginner or an accomplished scribe, the Indiana Writers Center is there to help you get your words on paper or on a screen. Travis DiNicola spoke with author and the center's director, Barb Shoup, about their current programs.
Barb, welcome back. Always great to see you here on Art of the Matter.
Always great to be here.
Well, thanks. So what is going on this fall at the Writers Center?
Well, we've got all kinds of things going on. We've got ongoing classes. If you go to our website, indianawriters.org, you can see the kinds of things that are coming up. Some are series classes that go over a couple of weeks. Others are single sessions. We've got a great memoir class coming up with Jim McGarrah. That'll be in December. And we've got a sort of a funny memoir class about writing about Christmas. So whether you love it or hate it, you can always take that class. That's good to get it off your chest one way or the other. So we've got lots of good classes.
And the classes generally are for adults?
The classes are for adults, although, you know, a junior or senior in high school would be fine in almost every one of those classes. Yeah. Maybe sophomores, but they're pitched for adults. But having taught high school kids for so many years,
sure,
I know that many of them are absolutely capable to handle them, and we would love to have them.
And where are the classes held?
The classes are generally at the Writers Center, which is sort of back behind the Art Center of Indianapolis,
sort of in
Broad Ripple.
Little brown building.
Yeah, that used to be a preschool.
Yeah, right behind the Art Center there.
Yep, that's where. And sometimes we have classes at Marion University. They're very generous in sharing space with us, particularly on the weekends. And then we're doing a whole bunch of classes with Indianapolis Public Library.
Oh, great.
So, and those are all free classes. So I particularly love those. And if you go to the library website, you can find what the schedules are. There are probably about 30 classes between maybe the 1st of October and the end of the year. And they're getting started. They're writing your memoir. And there's one on self-publishing. So there's a little something for everyone. And
now,
like I said, they're all free.
Most of those through the library, are those just sort of one-time classes?
Those are one-time classes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. We're talking to the library about doing a program in December and January that would also include a series class for people who are particularly interested in writing about their families.
And all of the classes... if you're a writer who's been writing for years, you're welcome. If you're someone who's just maybe getting into writing.
You know, the great thing about our classes is they're pretty, anybody can take them. They're very hands-on. They're very practical. And any level is usually, any person at any level is comfortable. You know, we'll get everything from the rank beginner to a cadre of Butler MFA students who regularly come over and take our classes because it's something different, you know, and they get you always walk away with something to do. It's practical, it's hands-on, and you'll have a piece of writing that you can develop. So we're doing something, I think, that's a little different than what's happening in the universities. And so it's fun. And all of our teachers are published writers, very good writers. The responses that we get from the people who take our classes, we always get excellent reviews. So come on down and try one.
Cool.
You'll feel welcome.
Yeah, especially, you know,
don't
it's
be afraid.
Not too early to start thinking about those New Year's resolutions. And if
no,
you know,
it's
people
not.
Have been thinking like, oh, this is the year I'm going to, you know, write that story.
It's
write
coming
that novel,
back around again.
Whatever,
and we always have a class, too. One of our first classes, the class session for this winter spring starts February 1st. It'll be New Year's resolution, so you can come and spend a day and we'll try to jumpstart you.
There you go. So you've got a lot of other events going on as well coming up.
Yeah, our big event is coming up, which is the Gathering of Writers. We do that every year in the fall. It's always a terrific day. The last few years, we have been doing it at Indiana Landmarks, which is such a wonderful venue for anything. It makes you feel just good to be there. It's a beautiful place to be. And that's been, people love that. So it's this year, it is on Saturday, November the 16th. It's an all day event.
Okay.
You can visit our Writer Center, www.indianawriters.org, and you can sign up online or else you can download a form and mail it in or call and we'll register you. The keynote speaker this year is Christopher Koch, who's an amazing, amazing Indiana writer. Mm-hmm. He was last year's winner of the Emerging Eugene and Marilyn Glick Emerging Author Award. So that's one of the reasons I wanted to have him back. I hadn't met him before, and I really loved both of his books. So
nice.
He'll do the keynote, and then we'll have breakout sessions with all kinds of interesting writers. Among them are...
So it's sort of like a mini one-day conference?
It's a one-day conference, yeah. and some of the writers that do the sessions are from all over the state. Lucretia Guerrero, Sean Lovelace from Muncie, Nicole Louise Reed from down in southern Indiana, Jim McGarra, Kelsey Timmerman, Sarah Layden, Sherry Wagner, Rob Griffith, also from Evansville, okay. and Norm Minnick. So it's a great group of people. We have sessions on poetry, fiction, and nonfiction, and then we'll have an open mic for an hour at the end so people can bring something of their own to read it and share. It's always a fun day. Love that day.
For the open mic, what's the is there a time limit?
We'll probably have like, 3 minutes or something like that. Don't bring your whole novel.
right.
We'll bring it, but...
Now, is there a book fair a part of that?
Yeah. Thanks for asking. We'll have all of the authors who are doing the workshops and doing the feature. All their books will be available, and a few books about writing that we particularly like and always recommend. So yeah, and we have our famous Writer Center prize wheel, which is my favorite thing in the whole world.
Mm-hmm.
I've never been on a prize wheel, and you know some authors are very happy to find themselves on it. Who has been on a prize wheel?
It's a pretty
cool
thing.
So it's just my little toy. And we put the people on it, and then you can spin it and win.
This is the prize wheel you've had out at like Pride Report Art Fair, right?
Exactly.
I love your prize
I don't know
wheel.
Why
yeah.
I like it so well. It just makes me laugh. makes me happy.
Yeah,
I know. It's thrilling, and there are prizes, and man, it's just so exciting. Dollar a spin, and it, you know.
What a deal.
Yeah.
So what's your website again for more information on the Gathering of Writers?
www.indianawriters.org.
Okay. Very good. Now, what else do you have going on? Because there's yet still more.
Oh, you know what? This fall has been so busy, I don't sleep anymore. I'm waiting for the first of the year for that. But we had a program that just ended that was called City Write. I don't know if you heard about that.
Yeah.
But it was fabulous. And we had volunteers and people writing all over the city for a whole week. I can't remember the numbers right now, but there were lots of people. We had 300 people writing. We had different sponsors and different sites, and we were all over the place. It was very, very cool. And another thing I'm really excited about is that we have launched a publishing imprint at the Writers Center.
Tell me a bit more about this.
Well, we're mainly publishing the anthologies from memoir projects that we do, and we do a fair number of those.
Mm-hmm.
The most recent one is called I Remember, and it's an anthology of student work from our summer program, but it's also going to be of interest especially to teachers and parents who want to work with their children with writing, because it has all the prompts, so it's like a little textbook too. We have a senior citizen's memoir that's called Returning, which has some great essays, and also like the other one, it has all the writing prompts, so if you're interested in writing memoir, you can get a start with that, which is cool. We are about to publish an anthology of writing that's called Monday Coffee and Other Stories of Mothering Children with Special Needs.
Hmm.
And that came out of a writing group that one of our instructors has had over the years. And it's all from mothers who are telling stories about, you know, what their lives are like.
Yeah.
And they're very honest and very touching stories that I think will be of value to people who have special needs children and who work with them. And I'm very excited about that.
So, Barb, you guys don't exactly have a big staff there at the...
That would be me.
Right. So I'm wondering, you know, for doing these anthologies and stuff, I mean, are you also the editor? Are you, you know, I mean, how does that all work?
Well, I just know a lot of fabulous people. And, you know, we get grants for things. And then if you find the right person, then you just let them go.
Yeah.
That's what I've always found
to
be the best way, you know, to make things happen. So I'm very fortunate to have a lot of people at the ready so that if I can get the grant money together, then we'll do it. And I just love it. And so that way we end up with a very eclectic sort of group of things that we do, because I have a tendency to say, well, let's go to the person and see what that person wants to do. and it always turns out to be something wonderful that we are very excited about. So, yeah, we're doing lots of stuff.
Very cool. Now, for these publications, and again, the name of that program?
It's called In Words. In Words. Like capital I, capital N, Words. Got and it. All of those books are available on Amazon.
I was just going to ask.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or you can find information about them, again, at our website.
Sure.
And it's kind of hard to find sometimes. You have to go under resources on our website, but you can order them that way as well.
Well, that's great. I mean, that's a whole other area that you guys are branching out into.
Yeah, and it's giving us a little revenue, which is pretty cool. Revenue
excellent.
Is good, right?
Revenue is always good.
Yeah.
Very good. Anything else? The classes, the free classes, the ongoing classes, the gathering of writers, the publications.
That's about it for now.
That's okay.
That's a lot.
That is a lot.
Yeah, and we're just, we are doing something new all the time and really, really enjoying that the people that we work with. I love the fact that we have people who are all ages who use the center and all different kinds of people from different backgrounds and writing at different levels. And I think that's what we do that nobody else is doing. And I like that. It's a very democratic sort of thing we've got going over there.
Barb, I want to ask you one question before we wrap things up. I mean, you've been involved in the Indianapolis writers and literary scene for quite a while. And it just seems like lately...
It's on fire.
There's so much more going on.
There's a lot going on.
I mean, I had a number
fabulous.
Of people say that to me or ask me if I think that, but it does seem, between what the Writers Center is doing, Indie Reads, of course, Ann Katz Festival of Books, Eugene and Marilyn Glick Awards just happened. But there's a lot of, it seems like there's also a lot more authors living here I don't know.
We have great writers living here and in the general, central Indiana, but all over Indiana.
Yeah.
That's one of the great things about my job is I'm always finding these new writers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so exciting. The other night at the library dinner for the Glick Awards, Mike Mullen lives here in town and he's a very, very successful young adult writer.
Right.
And so lucky us.
Yeah.
We have an amazing number of wonderful writers and a lot of them are community minded, which is cool. They're willing to come out and do something for books and kids and people and writing. And I think we're very fortunate that way. I think we have a very lively literary scene. Which is very exciting to me. It certainly hasn't always been that way.
That's a great thing to be a part of right now.
Yeah, and people are doing different kinds of things, and I think that's really cool. I don't feel like anybody's competing. Everybody is doing something different and, sort of helping each other along. So I like that part of it a lot, too.
Very good. Barb, thank you so much for coming in. Art of the Matter, always great to see you.
And it's always great to be here. Thanks, Travis.
Travis DiNicola with Indiana Writers Center Director Barb Shoup. You can get more information about all of their programs and classes, including the 2013 Gathering of Writers taking place this Saturday, November 16th at the Indiana Landmark Center at indianawriters.org. Get more at indianawriters.org. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
No matter whether you're listening to us at 8 o'clock on Thursday or 7 o'clock on Saturday, it's dark
outside. It's probably dark outside.
Oh, man. Yeah. It is. I know it's only fall, but it feels like midwinter. So since it's going to be dark and probably cold outside, we've got some things that we can suggest that people might want to do inside on our calendar we call.
What'll we do? Well, theaters are dark but warm places.
Indeed.
That's
that
what I'm thinking
true.
Of.
True.
And Wicked is opening up this week at Old National Center.
Big time.
Big time. And what a fun show it is. I remember the first time that I got to see it, and I was kind of like, oh, do I really want to go see the show? Whatever, and I went and I was just blown away by it.
I remember you talking about it.
Very,
about
very
that,
fun.
Yeah.
Well, one thing they're doing that's really cool is they've added a lottery for $25 seats. This is kind of neat. So every day of the performance, they're having a lottery. Limited number of orchestra seats are going to be held. And what you need to do is you show up 2.5 hours prior to the performance and you enter your name into a lottery drum. And then about 2 hours before the performance, the names will be drawn for a limited number of orchestra seats. $25 cash only. What a deal.
Whoa.
You have to do it in person and you can only get 2 tickets per person if you win that little lottery. But what a great idea.
Have time to go get dinner?
Yeah, still have time to go get dinner.
Snack,
Especially if you're a student or something on a little bit limited budget. I mean, great way to see a great show and so much fun. And so again, that's going to be at Old National Center, but try to win those lottery tickets.
Ooh, I love that.
Yeah, me too.
There's no lottery for this show, but over at the Phoenix Theater, it's the newest Stephen Dietz play. Stephen Dietz wrote Becky's New Car that the IRT produced. That was a lot of fun, a farce with a lot of fun aspects, including audience participation. The same year, the Phoenix Theater produced Yankee Tavern, which is
a government conspiracy theory play that was also a lot of fun. Well, he is back with a new play called Rancho Mirage, and it's about a group of couples who've been friends for a long time, but they don't know each other as well as they think they do. Mm-hmm. And over the course of a dinner party where the wine runs out, some long-held secrets come to light. That's all I'm going to tell you. It's a dark comedy.
I've been wanting to see that.
A lot of fun.
I need to get to that.
A lot of fun.
At the Phoenix. You know, and, well, speaking of the Phoenix, so Rancho Mirage is there now, but they've just announced the title of Very Phoenix Xmas 8,
yes.
Which is Angels We Have Heard While High. So that will open on November 29th, runs through the 22nd. If you haven't figured it out, yeah, it is kind of a tongue-in-cheek and somewhat adult spoof of the holidays, but what a great name this year. Looking forward to it. Looking forward to that.
Mm-hmm. Oh my goodness. Mm-hmm. Okay, so shifting gears, here's another indoor activity. This coming Monday, the 18th, from 7 to 10 at the Jazz Kitchen, the Icarus Ensemble, which is five guys with mostly classical careers by day. They get together and let loose with jazz at night, especially at the Jazz Kitchen. They do some really complicated charts, intriguing crossovers, little bluesy, a lot of jazz, a little bit of classical influence, of course. The Icarus Ensemble at the Jazz Kitchen, Monday the 18th, 7 to 10. Go, and they've got a great kitchen there, so you can have dinner and listen to some, reward yourself for making it through a Monday work day and go hear live jazz.
There you go. That's a great idea.
Yeah.
Hey, more theater. I can't help myself. At Christmas Carol, it's opening November 16th, which is you know, very fun. So there's lots of opportunities to see it between now and Christmas. But something that on Friday, and I know if you're listening to a Saturday morning, you just missed it, but that's okay. If you're listening Thursday night, then what you can do is if you go by the IRT between 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. on Friday afternoon, then you can make a donation to the Indiana Blood Center or Second Helpings, Toys for Tots. And then when you do that, you can get a free ticket to the performance on the 16th or on the 23rd, and then also some other cool things that are all about that. There's more information on the IRT's website, all about this, irtlive.com, to get the whole thing. But Christmas Carol does open this weekend, too.
Oh, yes. It's that time. If all the circulars in your newspaper and the ads on TV haven't convinced you, it's the holidays. Everyone. Hey, the Ann Katz Festival of Books had such a great success with its showing last week of Nikki's Family, which is an award-winning documentary about a very modest fellow who played a key role in kinder transport. A fellow named Sir Nicholas Winton, who at the time of right before World War II was a young Englishman who organized the rescue and relocation of 669 Jewish, Czech, and Slovak children, got them out of danger. And this is a very moving documentary about that chapter of history. He wanted no acclaim, and it wasn't until very late in his life that he finally opened up and told the story of how he got involved. So JCC had such a good showing last week that they're repeating this film on Wednesday,
great.
November 20th, mm-hmm. at 2 o'clock. Tickets are $8 to the general public, $5 to JCC members. It's at the JCC, 6701 Hoover Road. Again, that's Wednesday, the 20th, at 2 o'clock in the afternoon at the JCC.
Hey, just a reminder that on Sunday, the Viva Verde concert, which is celebrating all things Verde and Italian at the opera, is taking place. This is going to be from 2 to 4 p.m. at the Basile Opera Center. That's up at 40th and Pennsylvania. You get more information at indieopera.org. It's sort of a greatest hits of Verde, and there will be a Prosecco toast at the end of the performance.
Mm. Mm-hmm. People with Italian last names are especially invited to go. Mr. Di Nicola.
Yes, well, you notice that?
Hey, Encore Vocal Arts, speaking of classic opera, Encore Vocal Arts is presenting Timeless Love, which is a modern multimedia interpretation of the great Baroque opera Dido and Aeneas at 8 o'clock this Saturday night at Marion University at their theater. And a side note, Raymond Lepard did way earlier in his career, long before he came here to direct the ISO, did a spectacular Dido and Aeneas recording following many performances. So beautiful Baroque music performed by Encore Vocal Arts, but with some contemporary
adaptations multimedia aspects. So that's this Saturday night, 8 o'clock. That's November 16th at the Marion University Theater. More information at encorevocalarts.org. And go listen to Raymond Lepard's recording to get ready.
Hey, last thing I've got, just very quick reminder that also on Sunday the 17th, it's Student and Teacher Appreciation Day at the Symphony. You can get $10 tickets with your valid high school or college ID. People are encouraged to wear their college or high school gear and their clothes and stuff. And great concert, special concert. Let's see, Ravel is going to be performed as well as Debussy. And again, this is at 2 o'clock at the Symphony on Sunday for teachers and students.
My last item is the 1962 film Gypsy, which will be screened this Saturday night at 7 o'clock at the Garfield Park Arts Center. It's part of the Vintage Movie Night series, and Eric Grayson is hosting, and as always, he will tell you some groovy, little-known facts about this classic film. So that's Gypsy, 1962 movie, this Saturday night, 7 o'clock, Garfield Park Arts Center.
Very good. Sharon, we'll be back next week with that calendar we call
What Do We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
You know those commercials for the Dyson vacuum cleaner? That sleek and futuristic-looking appliance? Well, it almost looks like a modern sculpture, doesn't it? Yeah, well, we're not the only ones who think that. The Indianapolis Museum of Art is opening its new design galleries next weekend, and the Dyson DC-11 vacuum is one of the many spectacular examples of modern design that will be showcased. Sharon Gamble invited the IMA's CEO, Dr. Charles Venable, to our studios to find out more.
So something happened in the world of design around the time of the end of World War II. It feels like contemporary design started then. Is that a safe assessment?
Well, certainly I think for the United States you can say that. Certainly there were the stirrings of modern design earlier than that. There were some designers even as early as the 1890s and 1900 that were, you know, stripping away ornament and getting down to the basics of things. But I think really you could say that modern design as we know it started in Germany in the 1920s and 30s at something called the Bauhaus.
Mm-hmm.
And that did not survive World War II, but it was a teaching school. So it produced lots of professors and students who then fanned out mainly first in Central Europe. But because of the war, many of those individuals fled Nazi Germany and moved to the United States. And you really get a big push in modernism, streamlined. Whether it's car design or tableware or any other product, that really happened in the United States starting in the late 30s and the 40s.
And talk about, is the philosophy behind that to just jettison anything that isn't useful, to streamline something to its basic form?
Well, the axiom that you always hear is form follows function.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you go back far enough to what we might think of as our great-grandmother's Victorian house or something,
mm-hmm.
where there's lots of gugas and there's never a vacant space anywhere and there's ornament over every teacup.
Makes me nervous to hear you talking about
wallpaper and, you know, things are very, very, very busy.
Yeah.
Certainly when you move on in time and people were trying to be much more functional, much more precise, save on materials, be more efficient in being able to make things so that they could be sold cheaper, so that more people could have what they would have considered beautiful and simple objects,
mm-hmm.
You often have to get rid of the ornament in order to be able to produce those things in a very simple or simpler way to keep the cost down. And so many designers, and we call that modernism, when people really got down to just the basic elements, and usually they're quite simple to look at, but they can be very elegant and classic looking
mm-hmm.
Types of objects.
So there, my sense is there were also some developments in commerce, in engineering, manufacturing, that helped drive design post-World War II?
Oh, certainly. There were and World War II itself was a major driver of materials and new developments that were done for the war industry. So if you take a couple designing couple like Charles and Ray Eames, very well known for post-war design, mm-hmm. and they're some of their most famous things are made out of bent plywood mm-hmm. that were like their shell chairs from the mid 1940s. The reason they could use that technology is it was really invented during the war to produce things for the war effort. And one of their earliest designs, actually for the U.S. Navy, was leg splints for people who had been hurt during the war,
really?
And they needed to be carried off the battlefield or moved around on, let's say, an aircraft cruiser. They were making bent plywood medical devices that would be strapped to your leg to keep you safer while you were being moved to medical attention. And so after the war, of course, you didn't need millions of leg splints. When people were coming home from the war. So they experimented with those kind of processes to produce chairs and coffee tables and other things for a booming market as people came home and needed housing and all the GI Bill was going. So you get this huge boom in the need for housing and things to furnish your houses with in sure. this country. And that really did help modern design.
So some of the other materials, so plywood, what are some of the other materials that suddenly were available to designers?
Things like aluminum, which certainly there had been a few people using aluminum before the war, but aluminum was pretty expensive. And during the war, it was all used up by every country for their war efforts. So after the war, you have the ability to produce huge amounts of aluminum, but you don't have it going to the war effort. So it becomes cheaper, and you get designers saying, well, I'll make lightweight furniture. I'll make folding furniture that we all take for granted now. But that would have been pretty new and interesting then. There's some glass types of things that were produced for basically armor plating aircraft, for example. So the nose cones of planes where you would be looking out as the pilot, mm-hmm. Those were all produced by companies like Corning Glass and some others doing experimental technology. But after the war, of course, you're not making as many planes. So what right. are you going to do with your production capacity? So some of that stuff went into non-breakable Pyrex-like things and other kinds of dishes that you could stick in the oven and cook in, and then you could bring it out, eat out of it, and then you could throw it in the newfangled thing called the dishwasher, which came out in the late 1940s as well.
Yeah, thankfully.
Yes, we all are. Use it all the time.
That's right. So at the IMA, the Department of Design Arts was mm-hmm. created just a handful of years ago, 2007.
That's true. It was created in 2007. So it's a very new department at the museum. Some other departments have been around for literally, we just turned 130 years old recently. So this is a very new effort, a very avant-garde effort to be not just looking at design in total, but really concentrating on contemporary design, things that are very, very new. And so most of our collection actually was made after 1980, which, you know, for a young person might seem like mm-hmm. ancient days. For me, I remember 1980 well, but we have about 1,200 objects now in the collection that date from that time that are in the Design Arts Department.
So Design Arts encompasses what all would fit within
that's a great question. And, you know, museums divide up their collections in different ways.
Sure.
So practically for the IMA, it includes furniture, tableware, ceramics, glass, technology, mainly domestic and office type of technologies, computers, phones, those kind of things. We have a vacuum cleaner in the collection. We have numerous computers now that mostly look ancient, but they're not so old. however, in other museums, you know, we also have a fashion design department
sure.
that has its own curator and its own department division within the IMA, but luckily it's also the next gallery over. So we divide things up a little bit artificially, but design is everywhere.
Sure.
So whether it's the clothes we're wearing or the chairs we're sitting on or actually the automobiles we're driving, you know, you could just as easily MoMA, for example, Museum of Modern Art in New York, has some automobiles in its collection, which we don't yet, but who knows? We are with the Indianapolis 500, you just never know.
Yeah, absolutely. That would make great sense, actually. So before we talk a little bit more about some of the objects that will be on view, cite the new design galleries for us within the museum. Tell us where they are.
Certainly, if you're familiar with the IMA, you know we're a very, very large place. So when you walk in the front door into that glass oval and can be welcomed with our great visitor service people. To get to the design galleries, you want to go up the escalators. And if you want to take an elevator, you certainly can. But then if you want to take the scenic route up the escalators, the design galleries will be on the third floor. Contemporary is on the totally top floor. And then on the third floor, there'll be 10,000 square feet of new design galleries.
And there's a little kind of setting the scene entryway that
correct.
That
there's
helps
a 1,000-foot gallery in the beginning. beginning that talks about some of the things we've just been talking about, you know, what happened after the war from 1945 up to 1980. And then you, by the time you've gotten to 1980, you open – the galleries open up into 9,000 square feet, huge open space with hundreds of objects. In total, there's about 430 objects that will go on view in the first showing of these galleries in later in November.
So did something in particular happen around 1980? Is it kind of the reaching of critical mass of certain kinds of technology? So we were starting to think about how, well, 1983 or 4 is when the IBM PC was introduced. So
there certainly are some interesting things in technology going on. However, really it's divided that way because the late 70s and the early 80s are you get your first big rebellion against modernism. The things we were talking about, these sort of very functional, stripped down, somewhat simplistic in terms of their ornament, things like that. Mm-hmm. And you start getting a group of architects around the world, and certainly one of our own Hoosier architects, Michael Graves, was a leader in that. And so in the late 70s and particularly the early 80s, he started going back and looking at 19th century and 18th century things and updating them and putting pattern on them and making them ornamented in ways that nobody would have done in 1950, let's say. There were also some Italian architects who joined together to create a design school called Memphis, which was, while it was named, you know, more akin to Memphis, Tennessee, or Memphis in Egypt. Mm-hmm. It really was in Milan, Italy, and they did all kinds of extraordinary avant-garde things in the early 1980s. So that's a cleavage point in many ways to where you start getting a radically different style. And then the next 30 years after that up to where we are now has just been a blossoming of many, many, many competing types of styles out there in the marketplace.
And that's one of the interesting things for you, you and your colleagues as museum professionals, how do you name the, how mm-hmm. do you know when a new period has started? How do you name it? And, you know, modernism is kind of misleading because it started so long ago that, as you say, to somebody who's very young, they're like, well, that's not modern. That's right. 80 years ago. How could that be modern?
Well, it's, you know, it's like realist painting or abstraction. Abstractionist painting, those things have been around for a long time, and they still have practitioners today. So
right.
The way we've divided the galleries, even though modernism started earlier in the 20th century, it continued, it ebbed and flowed, and sometimes it got weaker, but it also now there are many, many practitioners of modernism making very simple, elegant types of design, and a lot of computer technology would fall into that. I mean, the iPhone, for example,
sure.
Something that many, many of us now are completely addicted to, and our other types of cell devices and carry around all day, those are very elegant, modernist, sort of reductive designs. They're not usually decorated. They don't have much texture to them.
Right.
They're very sleek little objects, even though we as consumers sometimes put them in cases and do other things with them to give them design, to make it more personal to us. So modernism still is a big bedrock of design, but we also like to talk about expressionist design or expressionism. So you would have architects like Zaha Hadid, the great Iranian, Iraqi British architect who does, like Frank Gehry, our own architect from Canada and the United States, who do these great buildings that are very much expressive, almost aggressive in the way that shapes spin out of them, and you almost walk through this wild landscapes of curves and different types of materials. And they also make furniture and objects as well. So we have them represented with smaller objects than buildings in these design galleries. But their stark contrast is simple minimalism.
You know, we mentioned vacuum cleaner earlier, so as our listeners probably have guessed, that's a Dyson vacuum
it
cleaner.
It is, absolutely. James Dyson, the British designer and vacuum cleaner king, I guess you would say, has, you know, a while ago revolutionized the technology of the vacuum cleaner by, you've all seen him on TV probably, with his sort of tornado in the middle of your
right.
vacuum cleaner, displacing something like old Hoover technology or Kirby right. technology. But he's also been very keen to make his things attractive and interesting to people. And it's as much because they're cool that you buy them, I'm sure, as before, because that's something that's the marketing and packaging of objects today. And so, yes, we have one of his best designs, the DC-11, actually. Is that the IMA?
Go look in your closet and see if that's the one you
that's
have
right.
if
that's
you're listening
true.
At home. What are a couple of your favorite objects that will be in the initial display?
Well, there's so many, and it, you know, taste is very personal. So I think all of our listeners will wander through, and you know, you might have been married together for 40 years, but you might pick out totally different things when you're walking through at the IMA. There's a beautiful chair by a French designer named Patrick Jouin, and it was produced around 2004, and it almost looks like it's made of icicles.
Ooh.
There's sort of these semi-clear icicle-type things that are all fitted together. And
is it Lucite?
It's a chair. And it's made out of resin, so something very similar to Lucite. But it's one of the first designs that was actually computer printed in 3D printing, which, you know, if I were a lot younger and in college now, probably you'd know a lot more about those kind of things because
yeah.
it's starting to happen. But it was pretty revolutionary in 2004 to be making something that you could order and actually use as furniture in the home. So that's a computer literally building up thousands and thousands of layers
yeah.
of resin to produce a finished chair. And so we have quite a lot of wonderful French design in the collections.
Sharon Gamble with the Indianapolis Museum of Arts, CEO Dr. Charles Venable. The new design galleries debut at the IMA next weekend. Learn more at imamuseum.org. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Vaselli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when we'll have an all Travis show.
Oh, my. First, I'll talk with young adult author John David Anderson, then find out what's going on this season with the Central Indiana Dance Ensemble, and finally chat with the young comedy writer and director Kenzie Suter about her new show at The Fringe. Plus, there'll be that arts counter we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.